Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in French Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roxanne Penchassi. My guest in this episode is Christy Pekicaro, the author of The Military Enlightenment, War and Culture from Louis XIV to Napoleon. And the book was published by Cornell University Press in 2017 originally, but came out in a new paperback edition at the end of 2020. Hi there, Christy.
Hi there, Roxanne.
Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for inviting me.
So, Christy, I've been asking a lot of my guests, you know, how life has been during this era of global pandemic. Do you want to tell us a little bit about where you are, where you've been, how you've been doing?
Yeah, such a big and important question. Thanks for asking. I think I'm starting to breathe a little bit now, thankfully. My family survived the pandemic, which is already saying a lot. Mm-hmm. But with all of the diversity work that I've been doing in my institution at George Mason University, where I'm an associate professor of history and French, and I'm also the director of diversity in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, and was working at a university level, co-chairing a committee of our Anti-Racism and Inclusive Excellence Task Force on University Policies and Practices. So reviewing all university policies and practices, thinking about anti-racism and anti-discrimination. So really, you know, that moment of the pandemic hitting, of the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, and the return of discussions about Adama Traoré, you know, all of that really engaged me in an intense way. I felt the need to step up my presence, my leadership within my institution, in my community, at a national level in our discipline. So I feel like I have been sprinting for 2 years. And I'm starting to breathe because I'm on sabbatical. I just simply was able to step away. I just spent 3 months in Scotland at the University of St. Andrews. And I'll make a plug for them, their Center for French History and Culture. They have a fellowship there that they run. And I was so fortunate to have been their fellow for this semester. And so that was just absolutely idyllic, fantastic intellectual community, beautiful place. So I moved out there with my family and took a break from race in America.
Christy, the other question I always ask people is, you know, why France? How did it happen that you became a historian of France?
Yes. How did France happen to me? Is a funny question, but it's actually something that I've been asking myself, I think, in a more serious way than ever before in these past couple of years. You know, I think three things made France happen to me. One is sheer serendipity. Another one is passion. And then another one is prestige in the face of misogynoir, anti-Black racism against women. So there's sort of a dark turn in the end, but that's been very revealing to me. The serendipity one is the funny one. So I was an undergraduate. I dropped out of pre-med, which was boring me to tears. And so I was studying African American studies, Italian, doing some East Asian studies. And at the same time, I had begun to sing opera. And I had a first career before coming into the academy, before doing my PhD. So I was singing opera at the Westminster Choir College with the brilliant, wonderful teacher named Julie Christensen. So that conservatory is where one of my previous vocal coaches had gone, and then also was just in the town of Princeton, just a few steps away. So I would make the pilgrimage over there every week. And was taking voice lessons and doing some sight singing, some of the musicological work, and then just music skills. Huh. And Julie Christensen, my teacher, said, well, listen, you are a young gal, but you are ready to go. You're ready to perform. So how would you like to fly to the south of France, to Nice? Mind you, I am like this biracial African descended and Italian woman, a descendant of immigrants from upstate New York, public school educated. Like, this was not, flying to the south of France to do anything really wasn't on my radar. So this is what happened. I went to Nice with this absolutely splendid pianist, Dalton Baldwin, who actually died in 2019. Dalton, we're still talking about you, as we should. He was such a beautiful pianist that his expression while playing with singers was at the same level of virtuosity and presence as the singers themselves. So, wow, what incredible privilege to work with him. So I went to Nice with Dalton and with Lorraine Newbar from Juilliard. And the future, I thought, was opened up for me. I saw myself singing opera there, driving a yellow Vespa, and living in this, what was predominantly where I was hanging out, an Italian community, which worked for me because I didn't speak any French. So I was speaking Italian, eating gnocchi, singing opera. And what happened was that Dalton and Lorraine got me into singing art songs, which are poems that are set to music. So I started singing these poems in French by Paul Verlaine, by Charles Baudelaire, that had been set to music by Claude Debussy. I fell in love absolutely with the poetry of Guillaume Apollinaire from the very beginning of the 20th century. And that was set to music by Poulenc, who is still my favorite composer. Mm. So I came back to Princeton and started studying French literature and wound up majoring in comparative literature with a thesis on representations of the fête galante, which were these aristocratic garden parties of the 17th and 18th centuries, as they were interpreted through different media and historical moments by painter Antoine Watteau, and later by Paul Verlaine. I had been singing these poems as they were set to music later by Debussy. Mm-hmm. So that's the passion part. That's the passion, serendipity and passion parts. Then there's the prestige and misogynoir parts, which is, I really would say, only something I've been able to verbalize in the past 2 years in this moment of reckoning with my own personal history and with our society. So I'll say about that, that as an undergraduate at Princeton and well before that, I really had a keen sense that as an African-descended woman of color, child, as I said, of Afro-German and Italian immigrant families, that my ambitions were unwelcome. And at times, I would say inconceivable in the ivory tower and in, let's say, analogous places, that in general were not meant to uplift people like me or people like you, Roxanne. Mm-hmm. So I know you know this well, that I was feeling like an outsider. And I was being judged by certain people as inferior because of my background, because of implicit bias. And this was despite the factual list of my achievements. So this is something that I've explored publicly with this term discriminatory gaslighting in some articles, in an NPR interview, this sense that people were sort of gaslighting me, as they do many others, into thinking that I wasn't enough and that I shouldn't be there. So, you know, it wasn't so much an imposter syndrome as a primary phenomenon. It was more like all the signals that we get and the things that are said to us directly that that indicate that we're not meant to be where we are. So facing this insidious culture and at times really blatant moments of racism and sexism, I understood, as many have before me, and as unfortunately people are understanding now, that I needed to arm myself somehow. Mm-hmm. And I felt that a good way to do that was with prestige, as a way of making space for myself in the room, if not even space at the table. So the prestige of the French language, of French literature and philosophy was appealing to me in this quest to be seen for what I am, which, you know, an intelligent, creative, high-achieving individual who can have impact and who deserves to be in these places and who hopefully, and it's my goal, wants to change things for the better through my scholarship, through public engagement and community work, and trying to clear the way so that other people of color can be seen and valued and they can just go ahead and pursue their dreams without the weight of these pressures and of the traumas that mm-hmm. come with them. So, you know, I'm very thankful to have had you as a partner in talking through this, in doing this work together. And Tyler Stovall, who passed away in mm-hmm. December 21, who I know meant a lot to both of us, he was a true role model to me and to many others in this.
Wow. I mean, Christy, I do want to talk about your book, and I promise we will. But I think, you know, everything that you've said is so important for me to hear, but also for everyone else to hear. And, you know, I recognize a couple of things in the story that you told, and I think there are a lot of other people who would say that as well. I want to know now, ask you now, how did you come to the subject of this book? And if there are connections you want to make between what you just said and that path, you know, feel free. But how did you come to work on military culture? and I say that as somebody who works on military culture. So
I know.
Because I want to be like, how did you cut? Tell us how that happened.
Yeah, thank you. There is a connection, Roxanne, in the sense that, so I did my PhD at Stanford. I think in that environment, I, again, with my prestige radar, I sensed, and not erroneously with Keith Michael Baker there and Dan Edelstein arriving, that the Enlightenment had this certain kind of cultural capital within the academy, that the serious people were talking about the Enlightenment. And I was, of course, wrong in the sense that there were absolutely stunning scholars. For example, Elisabeth Moudimbe-Bouilly, who was at Stanford at the time, absolutely brilliant scholar, you know, working on Francophone subjects and philosophy. And so, you know, but it was just the way that I had been trained to function, to look to where the fancy white guys were and try to go over there. And so.
Sorry, I'm going to need a moment.
I know. And we'll see if this makes it into the final recording, but I'm just telling you the truth.
Yeah.
So I had that sense. And then I thought, well, there's also this bonus of the fact that this was the era of abolition and, you know, the first abolition in France. And so I said, okay, this is good. Let me continue. And so I was sort of doing the canon work in both history and in literature. So sort of on the lit side, I was reading The Dangerous Liaisons, Les Liaisons Dangereuses by Chauderlot de Laclos. And there is, a predominant feature of that narrative, of that epistolary novel, is the presence of a kind of military vocabulary and military approaches to seduction, to jockeying for power in the elite society of Paris, in which the characters are operating. And so I noticed this, and folks had really only treated that as an extension of an age-old metaphor from the troubadours, from long ago, of the woman as a citadel that must be conquered. Mm. But as I was reading it, I thought, you know, this seems too literal, though. There's another depth to this vocabulary that makes it, for me, more of a way of thinking rather than a facile literary device that's been used for centuries. And then, so I looked into it and of course discovered that Laclos was a Freemason and an officer in the French army, that he wrote part of the novel while he was stationed in the southwest of France in order to help oversee the construction of fortifications against the British. Mm-hmm. So I said, holy moly, why are literary scholars not talking about this? How is it that not engaging with a historical approach is actually contributing to our missing vital information that would help us to interpret texts? So I sort of had that moment on the literary side. And then on the history side was the moment where I'm learning more about this classic Western civ narrative of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment is this time of illumination from whence our most excellent values and civilizations derive. It was a time of universalist values. And
what is this voice?
It's my Enlightenment it's my Enlightenment heroic voice.
It's awesome.
Right. So, you know, universalism, cosmopolitanism, scientific exploration, humanitarianism. It's back. The voice is back. All these projects to perfect society. And then most definitely projects regarding pacifism. And so there are sort of these book-ended works that people referred to, the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, and then Immanuel Kant later in the century talking about perpetual peace. And so I was reading all of this, and at the same time had started, because of the dangerous liaisons, looking a little bit into military history to find out more about military thought. And then I quickly realized that military historians referred to this same period as the Second Hundred Years' War between France and Britain. There is the War of Spanish Succession at the beginning of the 18th century, the War of Austrian Succession in the 1740s, the Seven Years' War that happened 1756 to 1763. After that, France is involved in the American Revolution. After that, the French Revolutionary Wars, and then we arrive at Napoleon. So right. I said, wow, these are two radically different visions of what the Enlightenment was about. And I was reading at the time also David Bell, The First Total War, such an important book that was talking about the culture of war. So I said to myself, there, these things, military and Enlightenment, we can't see these as this expression as an oxymoron, which is really what it appeared to be according to that Western civ narrative. I said there must be ways that the spheres of war and the military intersected with that of the Enlightenment. If we've got students and other types of scholars who listen to this wonderful podcast, this would be the moment when I would encourage them to just ask those big questions, to mm-hmm. go ahead and shake up disciplinary conventions, because important historical discoveries are sometimes hiding in plain sight.
I want to ask you about the French Empire-ness of this project
mm-hmm.
and, you know, what that means yeah. during this period that you're looking at in the book. And I guess, you know, going back to some of the things we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. you know, how you think of this book as doing the history of the Enlightenment, doing military history in this period differently, and what it means to think in terms of French Empire during this period, and especially overseas empire.
Yeah, thank you for this question, Roxanne, because it's really a key point in this book. And it is one of the ways in which I wanted to be sure to insert a different way of doing things and a different way of thinking than many of the military historians with whom I had been engaging, because the Continental Army of France was such an institution, and it grows exponentially during this period of time under Louis XIV. The fiscal military state becomes a colossal entity and disaster, in fact, as my colleague Guy Rollins talks about in his work. But somehow the focus was really always on the Continental Army. And I found that to be utterly shocking, knowing that by the late 18th century, France had navigated, dispatched missionaries, scientific teams, established trade posts, colonized lands on 6 of the 7 continents, and had sailed 3 of the 5 of the world's oceans. You know, there were merchants active in slave trade ports in West Africa, sugar plantations, penal colonies in the Caribbean, fisheries, fur trade posts in North American colonies, comptoirs on the Indian subcontinent, and in China, where there was trade. And then, of course, naval outposts in Madagascar and the Mascarene Islands, economic hubs throughout the Mediterranean. The French are all over the place. And these all became sort of theaters of war. People didn't have an understanding or didn't bother to understand that military officers occupied, and soldiers occupied, a number of important positions in these spaces, that war was a space of cultural encounter, that military men were governors general, diplomats, explorers, cartographers, pseudo-ethnographers, who actually relayed information about these places, their leaders, their cultures, their militaries from on the ground, as opposed to some theorists, in Europe, who said asinine, often completely racist things. One of my favorite stories of that is this French officer, Zacharie de Patsy de Bonneville, who absolutely tore apart this Dutch ethnographer, Cornelius de Paw, who wrote this work called Philosophical Research on the Americans, or Interesting Memoirs in the Service of the History of the Human Species, which was published in several editions in the late 1760s and early 1770s, where de Paw has just shockingly derogatory things to say about for individuals who are part of First Nations and Indigenous tribes. And so Bonneville, who spent significant time in North America, wrote his own treatise, which was called, the French title is crazy and long, but in English, it would be On America and Americans. And he refutes de Paw's work. And he says, you know, this guy doesn't have sufficient on the ground experience. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm not even going to bother to refute what he says, one by one, his claims, but I'm just going to speak these important framing concepts, which is to know that there's an extraordinary diversity of Indigenous peoples. It's not just one race or one type of person. There are many different nations. There are subcultures, national characters that exist among them. And that Indigenous peoples also, depending on their role, had differing personal status, and that each of these individuals had an autonomous identity and personality. So he, you know, was one of those voices who said, this guy de Paw, who's infantilizing Indigenous peoples and treating them as objects, is completely wrong. And that in fact, Indigenous peoples were, breathing, meritorious human beings. They're subjects, not objects. So, you know, I think it's just so key to understand that these military folks had on the ground experience. They had an ambiguous and often unarticulated relationship to empire, but in some instances, certainly there were supporters of empire, but there were others who were very critical of European cultural and colonial hegemony that would sort of put them into this other category of thinkers who were, in the end, against empire. So, you know, I really wanted to bring in this global perspective because it's part of that history. And we can no longer pretend that France was this, you know, and that the military was this continental enterprise alone, and just focus on the big names and the great battles. Mm-hmm. Many individuals and groups were involved in these wars. I talk about them, the female soldiers, free men of color who served in the Chasseurs d'Amérique in Saint-Domingue, thousands and thousands
of soldiers of any background, you know, who were Frenchmen, who were really in many ways voiceless and in some cases invisible in the hierarchical society of the Ancien Régime. And then historians were sort of replicating those same processes of silencing or not seeing. And so I really wanted to relay the experiences of these individuals as much as possible. It was a challenge. I think with more time, I could have done better, but I tried my best to reach them through the intermediaries that relayed some version of their voices and made them visible in some way to the crown, to the public, and to us, to posterity.
So, Christy, if I say that the Military Enlightenment, this book, is a history of affect, what say you, Christy Peticaro?
Well, Roxanne Panchasi, I like that. This is why I knew this was going to be so much fun, because you really are just so brilliant. I think that is a key point. It's a key point. And that sort of grows out of a couple of things. On the one hand, the vision of war and the mentality toward war at this time, you know, played an important role here. As I talk about in the intro to the book, people during this time thought that war was, and I quote Voltaire, an inevitable scourge. They felt that it was necessary for sovereign states in an age of global capitalism and what we would now refer to as racial capitalism with chattel slavery, that it was beneficial for reputations of sovereigns and their states in the culture of glory, the glory that was really centered at this time. And then also the sense that there were many problems in what was going on in the military sphere for France, that the global scale of war was untenable with this disastrous fiscal military state. There were huge, pretty devastating military failures, especially after the Seven Years' War. You know, the French cede Louisiana, west of the Mississippi to Spain. They lose New France, Nouvelle France, except for Saint-Pierre and Miquelon. They in India are decimated. French trading posts were seized. They are returned, but all fortifications were destroyed. So there's not going to be any strong military presence there anymore. And the Royal Navy captured all French establishments in West Africa and only returned the island of Gorée in the Treaty of Paris of 1763. France retains Guadeloupe, Martinique, St. Lucia, which had also been captured by the Brits, but they relinquished Dominica, Grenada, St. Vincent, the Grenadines, Tobago. So there's this a lot of trouble around this question of war, which made it sort of a perfect and urgent terrain for critical exploration and efforts to enlighten or to ameliorate. And you know, another brilliant colleague, Madeleine Dobie, remarks that this period saw the appearance, and I'm quoting her, the appearance of the first true meta-discourse on the aims and effects of war. And so this is where that question about affect and emotion comes in. These thinkers and actors are inheritors of Renaissance humanism in many ways, in combination with the culture of moral sentiment. Hervé Drévillon has theorized about military humanism out of the Renaissance's notion that war is essentially human in character, not so much divine in character, and that humans have the capacity, therefore, to define its principles and to bring rationality to it. And this concept of rationality and what becomes a sort of Cartesian warfare, the guerre de cabinet, cabinet warfare under Louis XIV in the 17th century and into the 18th, you know, is sort of evincing this rationality. But as the 18th century advances, an emotional and moral imperative get layered onto this, sort of shifting the nexus of change away from just states and states themselves, but toward individuals. You know, this meant concepts of moral philosophy coming into military thought. So humanité, sensibilité, sociabilité, honnêteté, civilité, these should be brought into military thought and practice. And ultimately, this
starts to give an image of what's in the encyclopedia article on war, which is the encyclopedia. I'm talking about the Diderot and d'Alembert, mm-hmm. which is this idea of making good war.
Right.
Faire bonne guerre. And that's where that question of affect comes in.
And so related, but maybe not totally overlapping question, how is this a gender history and I guess more specifically a history of masculinity?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I talk about this in the second chapter of the book, which is specifically about martial sociability and masculinity. So that's where I start to develop this subject. And indeed, there's a sense. Christopher Tozzi has written a book about foreigners in the French armies, more focusing on the revolution. But there's a chapter earlier in the 18th century, and I think it's important to understand that in the continent, in the continental armed forces, you already had a tremendous diversity of peoples from different regions. From different walks of life, from the most, from kings to paupers. Mm-hmm. And they all end up in this space of the armed forces. They don't all speak the same language. They have vastly different cultures. And so they're all coming together in the space of the military. And then, of course, in all of these colonial frontiers and trade frontiers, are these important relationships with allies, people who become mercenaries working for the French, or people upon whom, and I think this is really key also, it's a perspective that a military historian Wayne Lee and others have put forward, which is to say, we have bought a hook, line, and sinker, this narrative that the great European empires went and conquered all of these peoples. They didn't. They were highly dependent on their allies in these other parts of the world. They were dependent on them for manpower. They were dependent on them for supplies. They were dependent on them to know how to live in these drastically different climates, to combat disease. This history is much more sort of one of interdependency and sometimes, straight up dependency. Thinking about sociability, thinking about what constructs allyship in a deeper way, what makes an allegiance strong, is part of the query here. And so really interesting discussions are happening in India, specifically around language and cultural practice in order to build friendship with individuals like Hyder Ali Khan. And then, in continental France, talking about, what can bring these people together? So you have folks like Maurice de Saxe, who was a marshal of France, mounting a wartime theater while on campaign in the Low Countries, during the War of Austrian Succession in the 1740s, and he builds this theater, and he loved theater, and he loved actresses in a way that was absolutely sinister. In some cases, we have those stories of rape and mistreatment of actresses. Mm. But so the gendered aspect of this of building masculine bonds and masculine forms of entertainment sort of, at the expense of women was definitely occurring. We want the Enlightenment to be the Enlightenment that I was reciting with my fancy Enlightenment voice. We want it. we want that to be the Enlightenment. We want that to be the founding of the United States of America, the founding of the first republic in France. But the reality is, it was much more complex and much darker, much darker than that. And so, while this creative work is going on about military psychology, about building community, D'Argenson, the Comte d'Argenson, talking about how a unit should try to comport itself like one would do in a salon, where people from more common classes, as well as high royals and nobles, would come together and ostensibly be able to exchange on ideas in a productive and peaceful way, that folks needed to look at each other in these army units, build esprit de corps in a similar way. That's, again, that thought about civility. But this often, you know, leaves women behind or actually uses them, attempts to use them and exploit them in order to build up masculine ways of bonding.
Let's talk for a minute, Christy, about the chronological spread of the book and the sort of arc of the narrative here. I mean, I think most people wouldn't flinch, you know, to see a book with Enlightenment in the title that then, you know, covers this period from Louis XIV to Napoleon. Like, that might seem obvious to some people, but I guess I want to ask you a little bit about that reach, and especially those two bookends, you know, like how that works, especially the Napoleon part. Like, I think I was thinking as I was reading the book about how the most, like, the closest my students have ever gotten to physical violence against one another was a class where I had them debating, you know, that worn out question about whether Napoleon is a child of the Enlightenment, oh, yeah, great destroyer. I mean, I've never had my students be so mean to one another as in that discussion. Anyway, but I always think about it when I'm thinking about, you know, when Napoleon comes at the end of something and, like, what he kind of means and the role that he plays there. But yeah, also Louis XIV at the other end. So just, you know, whatever you want to say about how you were thinking about what had to be in this book, where it would start, where it would end, and what kind of story is being told across, like, the arc of these chapters.
Mm-hmm. So as I went into the military archive, so this search for information, so I'm researching this in, you know, between 2005 and 10. And so I'm able to get some sources that are published, right? Some military treatises that have been published in order to understand that thought, but in order to know what was going on the ground, and also to try to find these other voices, right? These other voices that I wanted to center about people who were really a voiceless and underrepresented in these other narratives. I needed to go into the military archive, and Rafe Blaufarb had written a fantastic book based on the 1M, the series of memoir et reconnaissance at the military archive. And so I went there with a pretty open mind, really not knowing much, and just, you know, just to see what people were thinking and how much that applied to the dangerous liaisons. And you know, so it was sort of started with this little thing that got bigger and bigger. And then I, you know, figured out this whole thing that was going on. But so as I looked in those memoirs, they sort of drew me backward into needing to engage with the last wars of Louis XIV and what was going on with that fiscal military state, and the way that the old approach to thinking about military officers, the old military system, was really dysfunctional. And so I was seeing some of the first memoirs crop up after that war of Spanish succession and the time of Louis XIV's death, so 1714-15, reflecting on that period. And Maurice de Saxe, who writes his Reveries in the period that follows, is making reference to the conversations he was having with folks who had fought in with Louis XIV. And so it seemed like a very natural and important starting point. And also in some ways a status quo ante for the changes that were going on. In terms of this discussion of crisis, military crisis in France, people had really pinpointed the Seven Years' War with all the loss that I described to you earlier. But, you know, from within the military, discussions had happened earlier. And I was also tracking in novels phenomena that had happened earlier. And in the moralist philosophers of the 17th century who were already talking about issues with war. So there was a sense in which it really needed to begin there. And I wanted to watch how some of those critiques of war by Pascal, by La Bruyère, by La Rochefoucauld are picked up later by people like Voltaire. And, you know, again, hiding in plain sight in chapter 23 of Candide, you know, it's like we've been reading this and teaching this in high school for how long? How come we didn't how come nobody understood that Voltaire in showing this scene of an admiral in England being beheaded was referring directly to something that happened during the Seven Years' War, where Admiral Byng was defeated by Admiral de la Glaçonnière of the French. He was judged in court martial as having been too conservative in his movements in naval battle. He's killed because of this. And so Voltaire isn't making up some crazy scenario. He is commenting on court martial policies. Right. So there's this way in which, you know, that some of this gets picked up by Enlightenment thinkers, by philosophes, by Voltaire in very specific ways. And then that there are these cultural changes. We see more of these conventions, these gentlemanly cartels. Again, going back to that notion of the individual level of action at a battle like Dettingen in 1743, war of Austrian succession, where Stair, where General Stair on the British side and Noailles on the French side decide together that we are going to wage this battle with all of the generosity and humanity possible. And they make this cartel that says we will not summarily execute prisoners. There will be a cost, a ransom for prisoners. We will treat the wounded, no matter what side they're on, and send them back under the general's passports. Passports were really fascinating at the time. They're not affiliated with each individual. Eddie Cola at Georgetown has done some really great work on this. So you actually travel under somebody else's passport. So a wounded would be sent back to their army under the general's passport, and you know, for safe passage. You know, these really important innovations are happening during the Enlightenment that are the precursors to the Geneva Conventions, that are the sort of the beginning thoughts about military psychology. And it's an incredible, again, going to that question of affect, incredible exploration of what people were going through after battle, during battle, after battle, and while conducting sieges, and just while on campaign, just life on campaign being awful. So this thinking about heroism in a broader way, a way that could include women, a way that could include indigenous peoples of North America, that could include people of color, African descended people who were located in the Caribbean, that could include people in the Indian subcontinent. You know, these were all innovations occurring at the time, as well as the sort of thought about the military community and esprit de corps, alongside other reforms in martial punishment. Arnaud Guignier studies this, reforms in the military system, for which Choiseul is very famous. You know, so there's this big moment, and then going to your students' vicious debate, is Napoleon, right? So the revolution happens, the levée en masse, the soldier is definitely a hero then, and then Napoleon, who we just have to accept, is a child of the Enlightenment and the breaker of the Enlightenment. He's doing both. And he's he's doing both. And he's continuing some parts of military Enlightenment thought, the sort of apotheosis in some ways of providing for his troops, of that emotional connection to troops. There's this quote by this captain, Blaise, who writes sort of nostalgically of how the emperor would take his own a Legion of Honor cross off of himself and fasten it to the chest of a soldier, and comparing this to Louis XIV, who thought nothing of his soldiers, for whom soldiers were cannon fodder. So there's that side, and then there's just absolutely disastrous total war and annihilation, and including, sadly, of his own soldiers in Russia. So you know, that debate in this case just has to stay where it is, which is he's both. He's both of those mm-hmm. things.
Yes. It was a terrible mistake that I made. I just wanted to see what would happen.
I've never asked that.
It was just a... Anyway.
Yes. No, it's good. You got to engage them. Hey, it's good that they were passionate about this period of French history. We'll take it. We early modernists, we'll take it.
This is what happens when you get somebody who works on the 1960s teaching the 18th and early 19th century. It goes sideways. Okay, so Christy, after Napoleon, you know, how should we think about the legacies of this period, of this moment of the military enlightenment, through the 19th century into the whole post 1945 period that mm-hmm, I work on? And mm-hmm. Like, how would you hope that historians of the later 19th century, 20th, and even 21st centuries would learn from this book and be able to use it to think about the military, about humane good war, mm-hmm. These other types of things in the periods that they work on?
Well, I think that, and I really hope that there is a lot to think about here. And I will tell you, it's sort of, I don't know what to think about it, and I want to be positive about it. But for example, the two translations that are getting underway of my book right now, one is happening in Chinese and one is happening in Russian. And so I think, Wow. Yeah, it's very interesting that what we might recognize or think of and you know, with a grain of salt, because we sort of drink the Kool-Aid of the West sometimes, whatever that is, in our own perspectives without knowing it. But that, you know, states that could be seen as more authoritarian and belligerent, certainly would have, you know, interest in thinking about this. And one would want them to be asking these questions. The legacy of this period of this moment of military enlightenment is as complex as the phenomenon was during the 18th century. There's good and bad. And I think the questions have to constantly be rearticulated surrounding the military systems and political entanglements, economic entanglements and interests that attend any particular period of history and of warfare. So as we think toward the 19th century, we have Clausewitz and these major thinkers who I think are really sort of coming out of the Napoleonic era and trying to process it, thinking about war from a phenomenological perspective. The sort of band of brothers continues to be explored and has become really such a trope now. You know, it's just a thing, the band of brothers. It was not a thing at the beginning of the 18th century. So Right. It's really pretty incredible how that continued to develop. But then at the same time, the exclusions from the band of brothers also remain. You know, in 2009, for example, the BBC document program found unearthed some papers from World War II attesting to the fact that Black colonial soldiers, who made up around two-thirds of the Free French forces, were deliberately removed from the unit that led the Allied advance into the French capital, which was freed on August 25th, 1944. So the racism, the usage of colonized bodies, the exploitation of these people, and then the sidelining of these people when there is a symbolic moment that would commemorate heroism. And of course, we know that many of the troupes indigènes who served the French nation were sort of brought together under this liberal Republican promise that they would have citizenship, that they would have pensions, that they would be brought into the state's care in a certain way. And this failed. This utterly failed. And, you know, Gregory Mann, others have shown that, for example, West African veterans of the French Armed Forces had their pensions frozen at the 1959 rate, which meant receiving 61 euros a month, 61 euros a month, compared to 690 a month for metropolitan veterans as of 2006. So the heights and the devastating shortcomings of this period continue to our day. And, you know, in the years of wars on terrorism, this has also continued. You know, the question of citizens being spared, prisoners of war not being mistreated, the Red Cross being permitted to operate as a neutral humanitarian organization. This was complicated in questions of terrorism because terrorists are not considered to be official combatants. They fall outside of the international laws of war, right? So they don't gain the rights that one would have under international laws of war. And so that opens up to all sorts of torture and to practices that otherwise are at least ostensibly banned from conduct in war. As we continue to use drones, which are also part of the legacy of this thinking about sparing civilians.
Yeah.
Guess who's being traumatized? It's the people pressing the button to release explosives in drone warfare. People who are trying to, you know, who are literally pulling the trigger thousands of miles away. So to my mind, Roxanne, and I'm very curious sort of you as a 20th century historian, as somebody who deals with nuclear weapons, you know, what your take is on what we can learn. But to my mind, as long as war continues to happen, these goals of making war less bad, figuring out how to do that, until we can get to that era of perpetual peace, we need to be pursuing military enlightenment.
I learned so much from reading this book as a kind of long genealogy of course, questions that I'm thinking about all the time with respect to, you know, soldiering, weapons, the relationship between conventional, nuclear, like all of these kinds of things come up in my own work. So I learned so much from reading the book, Christy. You mentioned that the book is coming out in a couple of translations. I guess I wanted to ask you, if you have other things that you'd want to share about the legacies of the book and, you know, what kinds of conversations you've had since it came out and what is next for you.
Yes. Well, thank you.
A lot, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly. Bars high, bars high. I'm setting the bar high. I like to set my bar high. You know, so the military enlightenment, I've just been really excited to see how it's being taken up. I will say that it has pretty much generated an entire subfield in military history. There are, you know, the military enlightenment, that expression, I did not invent that. John Lynn had used that expression. You know, it had been out there, but no one had really explored what it actually meant, and certainly what it meant in this broader global frame. But so in military history, it is booming. The military enlightenment is booming. I have people reaching out to me from all over the place to talk about the military enlightenment. There are two edited volumes that are underway right now about the military enlightenment, a sort of deeper dive into the operationalizing side within France. There's one that I'm doing with Hugh Davies, which is on the military enlightenment from even a bigger global perspective. Hugh Davies has been doing military enlightenment in the UK, in England. Eugene Myakinkov has written one about military enlightenment in Russia, finding analogous phenomena. So it's just completely taken off. Honestly, Roxanne, on the French history side, it has been a little bit slower to take off because Enlightenment scholars maybe still like their old version of the Enlightenment. And and so while people like...
I've never heard anybody say that before.
Yes, exactly. These are disciplinary hazards. You know, Colin Jones gave it this rave review, which just absolutely floored me. And he said, you know, Christy Bikikaro has turned an oxymoron into a truism. You know, this absolutely must be the way that we view the Enlightenment now. And you know, Guy Roland,
NBD.
Right. Woo! So you know, I'm really pleased at those nods and that you know, some folks have embraced it in that way. But I think in other ways, and I have to wonder about the ways that my own identity and perhaps my scholarly background in terms of being an interdisciplinary researcher have played into this sense that what women of color know, a woman of color can't have a big idea that changes the shape of a field. You know what I mean? Yeah. We can't have those big ideas. There's a problem if it came from us. And, you know, it's been said to me by several people, most of the time very, very generously, but it's also made me think when people have said to me, I wish I thought of that. And so, you know, I do wonder about that, but the book, I think, is just continuing to have its life as it's translated, as people are engaging it. I'm so grateful to you for offering me this chance to talk about the book that will, you know, further get it out there as concepts to think about in their genesis in this period and in this place, and the way that they took shape in other places and at other times, the way that this type of thinking is important now. So in general, I'm really pleased and I'm excited. I'm excited when people reach out to me and tell me the amazing things they're doing with this concept because it's a big one and it's a malleable one and it necessarily means different things in different places at different times. So I really love that. And it has led me to my current two book projects that I am working on. So there's a picture of this man. So the first in my book. So the first project that I'll be working on at the Stanford Humanities Center next year, which I'm super excited to have another bit of time to really focus on this and to exchange with an amazing community of scholars, is about the Chevalier de Saint-Georges, who was one of the most famous people of color in the 18th century French Empire and beyond. You have, you know, John Adams and different people writing about him in their letters. He was a fencer, a virtuosic fencer, violinist, composer, conductor, who becomes the first commander of the first all-Black unit in the regular French army. So that sort of all-Black regular French army are sort of important here in the sense that, and this happens during the French Revolution, because usually troops that had people of color in them were irregular units. So they weren't sort of viewed as, you know, brought into the military establishment under the same auspices as this unit, the Légion de Saint-Georges or the Légion des Américains. So my first book is about Saint-Georges, but it's sneakily not about him because it's about race and gender. It's about generations of women of color, his grandmother, his mother, and the sort of African-descended maternal knowledge that is so key to his understanding of kinship and the world and how we get free. It's about privilege, the privileges that he is able to attain through his military ties, through music, and through performing race in many cases. You know, these are very, very savvy people who understand processes of racialization and who navigate these systems. I'll tell you, he did not learn that from his white daddy. He learned that from his mother and from the women in his family, these African-descended women in Guadeloupe, who teach him about navigating these spaces and about that goal of getting free. So that is the book that I'm working on now. I have also started working on a book that is about Black power and not so much understood in the 20th century American sense, but really thinking about Blackness and about power in the 18th century and sort of the long 18th century, and thinking about African descended identities in relationship to that, specifically looking at who I've discovered are five generations of African descended soldiers who are fighting in the Continental French Army. So I've done a bunch of archival work on them. I have an upcoming trip to Benin to talk to the descendants of some of these individuals. So this project has led me into anthropological work, into historical archaeology, into more disciplinary transgression in order to tell the stories of anti-Blackness, of Black power in their infancy in this particular space and time.
Well, that all sounds incredibly exciting. Christy, I am so grateful to you for taking the time to speak with me and for writing this wonderful book.
Oh, well, it is for me to thank you, Roxanne. I truly appreciate it. You do so much for our community of scholars in creating these podcasts. Folks, tune in for more. Look at the backlist on the website. These are so fun and informative to listen to. I've absolutely loved listening to them and have learned so much. And so thank you for this work you're doing, and thank you for including me in it.